Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. The federal government sends BP a bill for $69 million to cover initial costs of responding to the nation's largest oil spill. The president heads back to the Gulf today for his second visit in 8 days. The Labor Department reports U.S. payrolls grew by 430,000 jobs in May. And the White House denies wrongdoing in talks with a Colorado Democrat about dropping out of the Senate primary. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup are John Dickerson of Slate.com. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
And Karen Tumulty, who joins us at the News Roundup for the first time in her new role as a correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us, Karen.
Great to be here.
And for the first time on the News Roundup, John King of CNN. He's the anchor of CNN's John King USA, which airs at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Thanks so much for being with us, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me in.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, John, we've got dramatic pictures from the Gulf of the effort to put the containment dome on top of that oil pipe. How is that going?
Well, one of the interesting things here is you get such little information at such crucial moments. Clearly, what we're hearing from officials is they believe this is progress. But if you look at the pictures, there's still a great deal or a decent amount of oil seeping out. The question is, are they quite finished? Do the cap fit as snugly as they would like? And so as the president hits the region today, that is certainly question number one. But one thing we do know, Susan, is that even if this is a success, it will contain much or most of the oil, not all of the oil. And so we're still looking at another 10 weeks or so until they drill these two relief wells trying to block off the source.
And what if it doesn't work, John Dickerson?
Well, if it doesn't work, we'll have more of these pictures. We may have these pictures anyway, but that we saw in the newspapers and across web pages today of these birds, these oil-soaked birds, and it will just keep flowing. Now there's talk about the oil going all the way up the Atlantic coast, beyond Florida. And so we'll know, they say, in about 24 hours if they've put the cap on, and there are sort of four vents on it they have to shut down to see if this will actually work. But even the best hope for the BP officials are saying is 90% of the oil will be captured. But the worry is that they'll run into the same problem they had when they tried to use the first top hat, which is that the oil, because it's so far down and it's so cold, that these sort of hydrates will build up, and that will make it impossible to siphon off the oil.
We've all learned a lot about the science, but we actually are more familiar with talking about the politics of something like this. Karen, we saw the president last night, the White House announcing he was canceling a trip for the second time planned to Indonesia and Australia. He heads back to the Gulf today. Why has he changed his trip plans?
Well, there are a number of things going on. I think this week really marked a turning point for this crisis, where it moved from the acute to the chronic phase. That essentially, as John said, we are looking at this kind of news at least into August, and probably many, many months beyond that. And I think, as a result, the White House has had to make some tactical and strategic changes this week. They kind of severed this relationship they had with BP, the oil company, where they were sort of joined at the hip at the podium. The Justice Department is now getting a lot more aggressive about potentially, filing charges against them. As you mentioned earlier, they have handed them this $69 million bill. I think at this point, the White House is both trying to get people prepared for the fact that this is going on, but also to put aside any lingering doubts that people might have had about the government's engagement on this.
Or do there continue to be doubts and criticism, John King, of the government's engagement in general and President Obama's engagement in particular?
There have been substance complaints and stylistic complaints, if you will. Some people say, why isn't he more visceral? Why isn't he more emotive? He had a conversation with our Larry King last night, and where the president said, look, I'm as frustrated as anyone, probably more frustrated than most, but venting and jumping up and down is not going to solve anything. My job is to fix the problem. On the substance side, you have heard from the governor of Louisiana in particular saying that I keep asking for things and everyone keeps saying I'm going to get them, but then either it goes up through four steps of the chain of command and has to come back down, or they call me to another meeting. there are always going to be disagreements like this. We saw it in Katrina. We've seen it in other crises. The governor's probably not right in everything he asks for, but he thinks he is at the time, nor is the federal government right in every decision it takes a week to make. They say they have now flattened what they call it, the chain of command, that the decision-making power is now on the scene, not so much in Washington. But that has been some of the criticism. Why aren't the booms coming faster? Why aren't the environmental relief help coming faster? Some of it's inevitable, and the White House and even the governor's staff says much of it is getting better, but he says he still has some problems.
But John Dickerson, you know, this is the president the country elected. No drama Obama, which was seen as a big strength during the 2008 election. Maybe not a surprise that he would continue to seem kind of cerebral as he deals with this crisis.
Right. I mean, nobody should be surprised that he's not fulfilling what people might want in terms of the theatrical part of the presidency. Where he's potentially in trouble, though, is the behind the scenes. So if people made a decision in the election that they weren't going to hire somebody who had that sort of immediate emotional response, they thought, okay, but we've got a guy who's going to be incredibly competent and who believes in the role of government and who behind closed doors is going to get the smartest people in a room, get consensus, and act. And that's where the problem is here. And the problem for the president, of course, is it's not just the speed of action. Sometimes you can do things very quickly that don't work. I mean, one of the worries that it's still out there is that these dispersants that are being used to break up the oil, that's the standard operating procedure, but they've never released this much dispersant at these levels in this amount. And so there is great worry among some scientists that it's actually the wrong thing to do. You save the beaches, but you ruin or hurt the water column and the fish. And so that in some sense, people are saying move really quickly, and other people are saying, look, we can flatten the organization, but we need to think a minute or two about some of the things we're doing to make sure that they don't make the situation worse.
And by the way, in case there isn't enough to worry about down there, it's also probably worth noting that this week marked the beginning of hurricane season. Right. And if one of these great storms comes along, it will both – they'll have to discontinue the containment effort, and it also could turn this into a much more broadly dispersed problem.
We had the Attorney General Eric Holder in the region on Tuesday announcing this launching of criminal and civil investigations. John King, what kind of charges conceivably could they be looking at?
Well, a number of things. Number one, if they did not keep on hand, and the CEO, Tony Hayward, has said they did not have the tools in their toolbox that they needed when this happened. There will be a question of whether this federal law and the plan they filed with the government require them to have those tools on hand. Were they negligent in that regard? And then if you read some of the documents that have been submitted to Congress already in its investigation, there is no doubt that in the 48 hours beforehand, and especially in the 4 to 6 hours before the explosion, a lot of people on the deck were saying the pressure readings are getting worse. We need to shut this down. There's something wrong. And one of the questions is, did the BP senior officials, this project was over budget and behind schedule, was there pressure to get it done where they ignored the warning signs and kept going after being told by people, we have a problem, we need to shut it down? So essentially, did they wait too long to throw that switch on the blowout preventer, and was the pressure already too high for the blowout preventer to do what it is supposed to do? It is the one failsafe, and it is a mile deep under the water, and it was supposed to shut this down if they had a problem. When they threw the switch, it didn't work. When they threw the backup switch, the battery was dead, and that didn't work. So a whole host of questions. Number one, did they have everything they were required by their own safety plan to have on the scene? That's one question. And the other question when it comes to a negligence issue is, when they were told we have a problem, did they ignore that?
John Dickerson, they've had their CEO out talking to reporters, appearing on television. How is BP doing, do you think, in answering people's questions and presenting their side of things?
It's not going well. I mean, it can't go well. They're the ones in charge of this hole in the ground that's spewing oil, and every time they try, it fails. Now, it's a very complicated thing, but if people want this thing shut off, they're in charge of shutting it off. It's not going to. And then there have been some misstatements. The CEO of BP saying, I want my life back. That's not good. In a situation in which not only are people's livelihoods being destroyed by the minute in the region, but of course in a situation where you've had 11 dead. One of the other things that Holder will be looking into is not only everything John mentioned, but there are also all of the Clean Water Act, there's the Migratory Bird Act, there are all of these statutes that may have been broken. And then most interestingly is the fraud that may have come after the accident happened or after the disaster started in terms of false statements. You've had the president essentially say BP misled him and the administration. You could argue perhaps prejudicing the case by saying, you know, they lied at various turns. And that's part of what Holder's looking into as well.
Karen, what about the administration's action this week to block all new offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, a lot of people thought that it happened already, but they had to revisit it this week.
Yeah, and there were mixed signals back and forth as to whether this applies to deep water drilling, which is what the BP rig was doing a mile down, or whether this also applies to shallow drilling in shallow water, where in shallow water there are spills all the time, but the technology is there to deal with it and to deal with it relatively quickly. And so there are a number of questions that are being raised, one of which is the livelihoods of this of people who are employed by this enormous industry.
What could the impact be, John King, on jobs in the region?
This is one of the complaints the president will get from Governor Jindal when he's there today, that he believes 20,000, maybe as many as 100,000 jobs over the next 6 months or so. And then he believes there's a potential domino effect because these offshore rigs, especially the deep water ones, are very expensive pieces of equipment. There aren't, quote unquote, enough of them for the challenges and operations around the world. He's afraid a lot of these companies will say, we're not going to wait 6 months because they're worried there'll be another 6 months or a year moratorium, that they'll move them somewhere else in the world. And it's when a car factory shuts down, we talk about it's not just the workers at the car factory, it's the dry cleaner in town, it's the pizza guy in town, it's the mom-and-pop restaurant and the mom-and-pop pharmacy. It's much the same in the offshore oil industry. You have the men and women who work on the rigs, you have the ferry boats that bring them in and out, the hotels that are home to them when they get their couple weeks off when they come off the rigs, plus all the restaurant and service industries that get involved. And Governor Jindal says that, you know, the spill is a devastating impact, number one, and he sees an economic domino effect if the government keeps this moratorium in place. It is a pretty feisty debate.
John King, he's anchor of CNN's John King USA and chief national correspondent for CNN. Karen Tumulty, national political reporter for The Washington Post. We're also joined this hour by John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com and CBS political analyst and contributor. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about this morning's disappointing jobs report. Stay with us. The U.S. economy added 431,000 jobs in May, and the unemployment rate dipped to 9.7%. John Dickerson, that sounds like good news, but in fact, you look behind these numbers, it's kind of disappointing.
That's right. It's a really big top-line number, and the administration should, in a sense, be happy. There have been 4 months of job growth before. But the problem is that only 41,000 of those jobs are from the private sector. The majority of those jobs are from the census process. And so it's a big number, but as a gauge of the underlying health of the economy, it's a very bad number for the White House.
You know, the president was out just a few minutes ago talking about the jobs number. He said the economy is getting stronger by the day, and this is evidence of that. He says we're moving in the right direction. He warns against going backwards, which Karen Tumulty must be a reference to Republican economic policies. Is this convincing, do you think, to Americans that we, in fact, are headed in the right direction on the economy?
Well, that is going to be the big question. I think everyone agrees when the elections come around in November is not so much where that number is, but whether people are truly convinced that the trajectory is going in the right direction. And right now it is going so slowly that for a lot of people, it's just hard to look around and see it and feel it in their own lives. And that is what I think, you know, what the administration and the Democrats in Congress in particular are hoping changes between now and at least Labor Day.
John King, what's your sense of how the country's feeling about the economy?
The president can rightly so make that case that there are economic statistics to support the fact that the recovery has begun and is beginning to take hold. But this is the most personal of issues in the sense that voters will judge this, Americans will judge this in their mood in October, November, by do they have a job? Does their neighbor have a job? Is somebody in their family threatened? How's their 401k doing? The key questions in an election year, the smart political consultants will tell you, is the unemployment rate, number one, which is going to be somewhere in the area of 9.5-10% come election day. That's bad for the president and the Democratic Party. And how do people feel about the direction of the country? And right now, in any survey about that, roughly 3/4 of Americans say the country's heading in the wrong direction. If that is the sense on election day, then the president and the Democrats are in for a tough year. That's history tells you that, and the numbers right now do not work in their favor.
Charlie Cook had an analysis this week that said that not since the Great Depression have we had a year-long period where the unemployment rate has been above 9%, but it's almost guaranteed that we're going to have that this year.
That's right. And you know, it's worth stressing the old truth, which is that as the president tries to sell his economic recovery, as he did earlier this week, you know, he has to be so ginger about or tread so gingerly around the idea of any improvement because he knows what John's talking about, which is that if you don't have a job yourself, when you hear somebody talking about improvement, you get sort of irritated. And they, you know, he tries to bubble wrap what he says, saying, you know, anybody who's out of job is hurting, and I know that, and show that he gets it, while at the same time trying to say, hey, things are improving a little better. It's very hard for him to convince people that things are getting better if they don't feel it in their own lives.
Karen Tumulty, a lot of these people who are unemployed have been unemployed for a long time, but Congress failed to extend the extended unemployment benefits before it left on the Memorial Day recess. Sir, come back next week. Will Congress get this passed?
I think it will. I think they absolutely have to. And in some states, benefits have been extended. So, this is one of these things that particularly in an election year has got to get done.
We're going to go to the phones in just a moment. You can call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850. We've got an email from Keith in Silver Spring about some of our comments about the president's failure maybe to emotionally connect with Americans when it comes to the oil spill. It's one of several similar emails we've gotten so far. He writes, as soon as the president loses his temper about the oil leak, he'll be called out of control. These people can't have it both ways. The anger should be directed at BP. So Karen was talking about, and John, about the line that President Obama has to walk on unemployment. He's got one maybe when it comes to the oil spill, too.
And look, he is who he is. And the email is entirely correct. You know, life and politics are not fair. And if the president were highly emotional, people would say, you know, calm down and do your job. And when he's not highly emotional, people say, why isn't this making you mad? Look, the coastline is being destroyed. This company has, you know, maybe not giving you the honest information. So he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't, to an extent. In part, we judge everything in our life by the last one. And, you know, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton were very visceral, very emotional guys. And so this president isn't. And in many ways, that benefits him, the detached Mr. Cool. It certainly helped him get elected. And there are some occasions where people say, I wish he'd get a little more fired up.
I think people get irritated at all of us when we talk about this part of the president's job because they think, you know, he should just be focused on cleaning up. And they have a very good case to make in that regard. But there is a way in which the president and what he does in public matters. And it's when you go out and do interviews with regular people, it's what they talk about, those touchstones. And one thing he did this week is he said, I'm going to fight to pass comprehensive energy legislation. And that was a big deal. The president, you know, put his energy and emotion behind a project, and on the Hill, people started talking about it, and it made news. It pushed the story in a direction, and that's a way in which the president, merely by saying something, generates activity. And so that's a positive way in which he has generated activity. So it's not just associated with, you know, is he sufficiently angry about the oil that's coming out?
You know, the president's comments on the energy bill were interesting, I thought, because there was some initial thought that the oil spill made the energy bill even more stalled than it's been because it calls for additional offshore drilling. Is there a chance, Karen Tumulty, that this bill actually makes it through this year?
Well, Harry Reid now says that he will be bringing it up in the Senate. So we are going to know the answer to that very soon. I still think the odds are probably very much against it. And of course, the president was exposed on this politically because it was 3 weeks before this spill that he did come out with his plan to dramatically expand offshore drilling. And he was doing that specifically to win over a few votes for his more comprehensive energy strategy.
We had another political controversy this week over whether the White House has been offering jobs to Democrats who are considering primary challenges. They have to kind of clear the field for their preferred nominee. And this week it involved the Colorado State House Speaker, Andrew Romanoff, who's running there against Michael Bennett, the appointed senator. John, did the White House, does it look like the White House actually broke the law?
I'll leave that to the lawyers. There are some Republicans who say, yes, that if you induce somebody to get out of a political race with an offer of a job, that you have crossed the line. They cite a particular statute. Most lawyers who've worked in politics and in the White House in the past say, no, you have to be very specific and that this doesn't meet that test. What they have done is open themselves up to controversy for failing, I'll use that word, the transparency test. They have said they would be the most transparent administration in history, and they have been very reluctant to provide the details about these offers. This will be shocking to everybody out there listening. The president's a politician, and they do these things. And we could probably go back to George Washington and find evidence of these things. What potentially hurts them somewhat politically is that he did run a campaign where the central promise was to end the shenanigans of Washington and to make it different and to stop the backroom deals and to stop the behavior that offends a lot of people. And he's engaging in some of it just like every one of his predecessors. The Republicans don't have the votes to get an investigation. Most people tell you no, they didn't break the law. They probably just played hardball politics.
I'm struck by how singularly unsuccessful they were in getting anybody to clear the field. The Bush White House was really effective at it. I mean, I remember them clearing the field in North Carolina, in Minnesota, when Tim Pawlenty was on the verge of running for the Senate. It took a phone call from Dick Cheney saying, get out of that race and go run for governor. And White Houses offer all kinds of things to candidates, and most notably fundraising help. I mean, that is cash on the barrelhead.
But is it a good defense, do you think, to say this is how it works? Every White House does this, kind of, so what?
It's not great. It's the only one they have available to them. What's compounded this and on the transparency front is there's the facts of the case. In these two instances, you have the Colorado Senate race and then the previous Pennsylvania Senate race, in which the facts help the White House more. No specific job. Well, they say in the Colorado case, no specific job was offered, but three jobs were put out there in what pretty much looks like a job offer. In Pennsylvania, it wasn't a White House official. It was former President Bill Clinton. But it took months and months and months for the White House to come up with the details of this. And that's where essentially the White House answer was, look, trust us. Nothing was done wrong. Well, that's where, in the transparency sense, the administration failed at first, leaving aside the details of the actual backroom deals. It's basically saying, we don't need to give you the details. Just trust us. And that, a White House can't get away with that.
My favorite email on this, and there's been lots of email traffic from political groups, was one that questioned whether the White House had given up on the reelection of Senator Blanche Lincoln because they apparently did not offer a job to the lieutenant governor who is challenging her in that primary. Well, let's go to the phones. In fact, let's go to Arkansas. We'll go talk to Billy, who's holding on. Billy, hi.
Hi. I've wanted to make a couple of comments about the oil spill. I'm absolutely mortified of what's going on, and not only me, but all my friends are sick and tired of the government and BP arguing back and forth. And we all think that the biggest mistake that was made was the government should have handled the cleanup and the prevention of the oil getting to the shoreline, and BP should have concentrated on stopping the leak. But this is not just a disaster, the worst disaster in American history. It's the worst disaster in world history on the scale of Chernobyl. And I also wanted to say that the president has done I don't agree with everything he's done, but I think he's done a very good job. And yes, he is a politician, but I think that by him going down there, at least this is his third time, he's at least showing that he's trying to keep up with what's going on. Of course, he can't do it himself. And I forgot what else I was going to say because as I was listening on the phone, you guys changed subject. But anyway, I used to be a rabid Democrat, and now I can't stand what they're doing, and I can't stomach the Republicans. So I don't know what I'm going to do, but I think we need a third party in America to sort of have an alternative. But some of these other parties are very out there. I'm inclined to support the Green Party, but anyway, thank you for letting me make my comment.
Okay, Billy, thank you so much for your call. Karen.
Well, I was interested in his differentiation, and I think that's a good one, that where the government's role truly, truly does begin is in dealing with the containment and keeping that oil from reaching the shore and doing damage. But the fact is the government doesn't have the technology to plug the hole. Military submarines can't go that deep. So we really are in this position of having to rely on the company that created the problem to fix it when it comes to actually stopping that leak.
John?
Another interesting thing that struck me is that Billy is representative of something that's happening all across the country, people who are very frustrated with both parties and wish they had another home. The one thing the two parties agree on is that they do not want to create an opportunity for it to be easier to have the creation of some kind of a third party, because they understand people are so frustrated right now. Susan, the one thing any good Democrat or Republican strategist would tell you is they have not seen a moment like this in their lifetime, including the Ross Perot movement, for somebody to step forward and say, you know what, we need some grown-ups. We need a new way of doing things. Luckily for both the Democrats and the Republicans, it costs so much money. The infrastructure of starting a new effort is just beyond most people's reach.
Well, we do have some credible independent candidates this year. We've got Charlie Crist in Florida. He's been a Republican governor, but running as an independent right. in the Senate race. We've got three credible independent candidates for governor in New England. What are the prospects that enough people are so unhappy that the third parties actually have a chance to get a leg up? John Dickerson?
Well, the prospects are there because of the sentiment Billy expressed. And Chris is the one that's most interesting, because he's you've got kind of all the interesting things going on in that race. You have the independent candidate. You also have the Tea Party movement getting behind the conservative candidate. And now you also have the oil spill coming. And Chris, as the governor, has an opportunity to show himself in command or be tagged as out of touch. And so you have all of these political stories coming into one place there.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Well, the Supreme Court this week loosened enforcement of the Miranda rule. Karen, tell us about this case.
Well, this was a case where a suspect was, rather than declaring his right to remain silent, he simply remained silent. And what the court decided was that it was a narrow decision, one that Elena Kagan had, as Solicitor General, had argued with the conservative majority of the court. Justice Stevens, who she would replace, was on the other side, where they basically said, your right to remain silent begins only when you declare that. You cannot just simply remain silent.
Sonia Sotomayor, the newest justice on the court, was in the opposition to the majority decision. She called it a substantial retreat from protections that had previously been seen.
Her case is that the burden is on the government to explain your rights. It is not on you to understand your rights and assert them. Essentially, whose authority? Who is the decision maker in the room? Justice Sotomayor saying that, no, if you're sitting there silent, you're exercising your rights. And if the government has issue with that, it is up to the police to explain them, or the other lawyers in the room to explain it. It's a question of whose responsibility is it? And she is essentially saying that the person apprehended may not have the full understanding that the police and the lawyers around them do, so the burden is on them.
In this case, a suspect had said nothing for 2 hours and 45 minutes, and then the police officer asked, do you pray to God to forgive you for shooting that boy? And he responded, yes, and he was convicted of first-degree murder, largely on the basis of that one word.
That's right. And and Sotomayor said it, to now assert your right to remain silent, you have to talk, getting at the kind of inconsistency here.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Will, who's calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Will, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to mention that with the Republican Party not doing anything in Washington, it makes me wonder just how relevant they really are, because things are getting done through the Obama administration, and it may be slow, but at least he's getting things done. And like everyone else has said, we've never seen anything like this, and it's absurd.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. You know, there is a White House response to the criticism that they're not achieving things by looking at the fact that financial regulation bill is passed. He's likely to get Elena Kagan confirmed. How do you think his record stacks up in this period? And John King, will the oil spill be a distraction in getting some of these things done that they'd hope to get done this year?
I think the oil spill will add to a big cloud over the Congress in terms of the political will and the political ability to get additional things done this year. The administration, Susan, can make a very strong case and build a very strong list saying the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act, the health care bill, the economic stimulus bill. Now, all of those are controversial, the Lilly Ledbetter much less so. And they can go on and on about things that they can say are significant achievements and are promises the president has kept. Without a doubt, they can do that. The Republicans can counter by saying 9.7% unemployment, the health care bill costs too much money, the deficit has gone way, way up. And so that is the tension that is our election season this year. Will they finish the financial regulation? Probably. A lot of money being spent to lobby that one. So when I say probably, I could eat those words. But there's not much more big things we'll get done this year.
We're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we'll go to the phones. We'll take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Continued fallout from Israel's action against a Gaza aid flotilla. The Taliban targets a national peace conference in Afghanistan. And Japan elects a new prime minister. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio for the domestic hour of our weekly news roundup, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, and John King of CNN. You know, we were talking about the impact this oil spill is going to have or could have on the president's agenda, the Congress's agenda for the rest of the week. We heard the president take a somewhat different tone this week when he gave a speech in Pittsburgh. John Dickerson, tell us about it.
That's right. Well, the president has increasingly at Democratic events turned up the heat on Republicans. But this was a speech that was billed to be about the economy, and he did talk at some length about the economy. But he made an extended critique of the Republicans, his harshest to date, and it's certainly harshest in a sort of public platform like that, in which he said basically Republicans had gotten together before he was even inaugurated and decided if he failed, they would win. Then he said, in addition to being politically motivated. Their ideology essentially was to offer plans that only offered more tax cuts for the rich. And then he talked about how they lacked a fundamental interest in the safety net that helps people when they're down on their luck, and that they also lack any interest in dealing with corporations and regulating them in any fashion. And it went on at some length throughout this whole speech. Now, this was something that Democratic strategists have been begging for from the president. He is still the most popular national Democrat. The Democratic National Committee's strategy relies on two things: getting the president to sell the economy and helping to convince people that it's that it's improving, and it's improving because of the president's policies, and also getting him to define the opposition, because they want this election, as we've heard many times before, to be a choice between a Republican and a Democrat, not a referendum on the Obama administration. And by defining the Republicans as do nothing, and as in this case, not even interested in the minimum job a government can do, that's an attempt to drive those numbers down to the Republicans.
This is so important to the Democrats, who have felt no small amount of anguish as the president has toured the country and decried, you know, Washington is broken, Washington is broken. They feel like with them running both houses of Congress, they need him to finish that sentence and say Washington is broken because of the Republicans.
So, John King, why has he been reluctant in the past to make that political argument?
In part because to get some of the big things he had hoped to get done, climate change and energy bill, immigration reform, he had hoped early on health care. That proved to be a futile effort. But he wanted Republicans in some regard. And he also knows one of the bigger criticisms of him is that he hasn't made Washington different. So he is trying to reach out to Republicans sometimes for his own political portfolio, if you will. But the clock is ticking, and the biggest priority now, he's not on the ballot in November. And Democrats want a much more confrontational, a much more contrasting president out there, because he is the energy of the party.
Lots of speculation about whether Republicans have the opportunity to win back control of the House, perhaps even of the Senate, in November. John Dickerson, how do you rate the odds now?
I think the odds to take over the Senate, the odds are very long. To take over the House, you talk to the experts, and they say that, you know, basically there are about 27 to 35 seats that are gone, that because of history and Democrats did very well in the 2006 and 2008 elections, putting Democrats in seats that they really had no business controlling. These are Republican districts. So that's the bottom end of the losses. Then experts sort of have another tranche. There's about 10 to 15 races that are pretty likely at going out the door to the Republicans. Then there are about another 10 on top of that are in contention. And then on top of that, and this gets you close to that number John Boehner threw out there when he said John Boehner, the minority leader in the House for the Republicans, said there were 100 races in play. Then you sort of the last 10 or 15 in that number are races in which, if it's a wave year in which Democrats just get pasted, then it gets you close to, you know, maybe 60 losses.
And Republicans need, what, 41, a gain of 41 to take the House? I think that's right.
Yeah.
You know, it's true that the Senate looks like a reach, but my understanding is that in U.S. history, the House has never flipped unless the Senate flipped too, that the House always brings the Senate with it. It's just harder to see in advance.
You know, I don't think we can see anything until at least Labor Day. Let's face it.
But 90, what will we talk
right,
about here?
Sure. Yeah. No, but I mean, it's just worth sort of putting that perspective on. I mean, in 1994, it was not clear until 3 or 4 weeks before the election that there was, in fact, something really big happening out there. And the political climate has plenty of time to shift.
And we spend a lot of time in Washington, rightly so, looking at that list of 75 to 80 House races, looking at the 36 Senate races in which 15 are really going to be competitive. But to Karen's point, in 1994, where you started to realize it late was when you were out doing those big governor's races, because not only do governors run statewide, they assemble the party operation, they assemble the turnout operation, they can also use money in the last few weeks of a campaign in ways that Senate candidates and House candidates cannot. So if you have a competitive governor's race in a state that also has a Senate election and maybe one or two, or in some cases three or four targeted House races, that governor's race in the end can be a big contributor to that wave. That's what we need to look at come late August and into September and beyond.
Let's talk to Diane. She's calling us from Orlando, Florida. Diane, thanks for holding on.
Hi. My question has to do with unemployment in this country and the relationship with businesses, corporations being able to take their jobs overseas, as has been occurring in the last several years. And it seems to me our country, and I guess the whole world, is heading towards globalization. So our focus on whether there's employment or not employment in this country seems to me to be like going through the back door. It's like it's out of our hands.
All right. Thanks for your call, Diane.
That's why the president has tried in selling energy, and he will do it again in trying to sell comprehensive energy legislation, to argue that the kinds of programs that he wants to put in place to put America on a sounder footing with respect to its energy, these are jobs that can't go overseas. That the retrofitting homes is something that you can't do in India or China, and that creating these kinds of domestic sources of alternative energy it's a domestic jobs program is the way that he will try and sell that.
Let's talk to Paul. He's calling us from Louisville, Kentucky. Paul, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Yes, absolutely. Please go ahead.
Okay. I had a question about the oil spill, and I guess it's kind of a comment. Why are we relying on BP as the only source to fix the problem? I understand that the government doesn't have the technology to actually plug the spill. BP, this is what they do. They drill. But there are a lot of other companies that do the same thing. They drill for a living. They get at oil for a living. Why does the government not set up, I would almost call it like a bounty, but a prize, you could call it, of some kind, and put it up to the open market and say if any other company can get this plugged, then let them do it. And they can, collect this bounty, and then the government can turn around and charge BP the cost of the bounty, because clearly they're going to charge BP anyway for whatever the cost of the cleanup is, or at least that's what they're saying. Why not open it up to the free market?
All right. Paul, thanks for your call. Karen.
That's a very good question, Paul, and it's one that has been asked of Admiral Thad Allen, who's the commander on the ground there. He says that what they did was that they actually consulted with a lot of other oil companies that do this kind of work, and that they were told essentially what BP is doing is what we'd be doing. And, this is a situation where you really can't be bringing in a whole lot of people onto the scene with, their robots running into each other or whatever.
Well, although, Paul's idea seems like a very American one, right? Like, let's try to find the best idea. We saw this week the EPA and other federal agents met with James Cameron, the film director, to talk about what he would do, because he's done all these underwater kinds of movies.
And they're searching far and wide, as Karen said, all the other companies, James Cameron, looking for any innovative ideas. The James Cameron inquiry was more about his good history of fascinating underwater photography. So how can we get down and take a closer look at this if we need to? How do you do these underwater operations? This will have a bigger ramification, I think, the idea of why aren't there other people available to do this? Why isn't there somebody on call that you can get to do this in the next round of this? The future of deep water drilling is going to include a very large regulatory debate about this has proven that you can't throw a switch and fix something like this quickly. So what types of technology, backup systems, protective systems will have to be in place in the future is going to be a big part of this.
We have a question posted on Facebook that says, I'd like the guests to discuss how the conservatives can, on one hand, yell, keep government out of business, but then yell, Obama isn't doing enough about the BP spill. What do you think about that, John Dickerson?
Well, they can do it because they don't have to. They're not in charge, and this is what the opposition party does, which is have it both ways. And they hope, look, Democrats did it too when they weren't in charge. This is what happens in politics. There are also the different challenges here, and it's up to the president to kind of try and explain to people what he has control over and what he doesn't have control over. In terms of the cleanup, which is the area where he does have the most control, I've talked to people who've been involved in different kinds of crises. And in terms of the James Cameron thing, what they say is the key is not just rushing down and doing everything you can by the playbook you have, but knowing at some point when the crisis is so big and so overwhelming that even though you're spending 25 hours a day trying to take care of the incoming, that you have to have a procedure where somebody says, we have to think about this in a totally new way, because that's where the solutions come to deal with a problem of this magnitude. It's an almost impossible thing to do because, the James Cameron thing, a lot of people laughed at and said, why aren't you guys dealing with the problem at hand? And so you get a lot of ridicule for trying to think creatively. And then, as one of us mentioned earlier, the problem then is also you have a great idea and there's no operational capacity to carry it out. There just isn't isn't, you know, the bureaucracy isn't set up to take your great idea and put it immediately into process.
Now, one of the things I read about this week was the nuclear option. Who can tell us about that, John?
Well, there have been a whole host of ideas that have come out, including people saying, look, the Russians have done this. When they have had offshore spills, they have used small nuclear devices deep below the water to essentially implode the hole. And I've received emails from people in the military and connected to the military contractor types dismissing that option, but saying there are these heavy bombs, these bunker-busting bombs, that, boy, could you drop one of them down somehow to close this hole? The creative part of it is interesting, that you see everyone thinking outside of the box. I don't think anybody wants to use a small nuclear device a couple miles off the Louisiana shore. But the fact that everyone is thinking outside the box tells you that there's the depth of this problem. To John's point also, Susan, priority one is dealing with this leak, but there's a 25, 30-year problem here in trying to figure out what has happened to the ecosystem, what has happened to those marshlands. You see the horrific pictures, more and more birds being soaked now. And those marshlands are critical to support all that life, to support the fishing industry, and also they protect the coast from hurricanes. And so this is an urgent problem today, tomorrow, next week, but there's a 25, 30-year legacy of this that we're going to have to come to grips with.
I wonder if this could have a long-term effect on that balancing act we have as a country between promoting economic development and protecting the environment. In a USA Today Gallup poll last week, we found there had been a real shift toward protecting the environment, even at some economic costs, although we don't know yet whether that's a long-lasting shift or something that's just in the immediate aftermath.
And those of us who've lived through a few oil crises know there is no subject on which the American public seems to have more amnesia than on energy security.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Naples, Florida, and talk to Casey. Casey, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to make a comment about something an earlier caller brought up about people not having anywhere to look in politics for someone they can really respect and look up to. I believe, as well as so many others, believe that people should realize that Dr. Ron Paul of Texas is the man that we need to look up to. And I know your guest, John King, interviewed him. He might be able to say something about that.
All right. And what appeals to you about Ron Paul?
I think that many people believe that we have a constitution for a reason, and Dr. Paul seems to be the only one of the politicians who thinks that same way. And if people go on YouTube and see what he has to say in the debates and really look at him or read his books, they'll agree with everything he says, if you ask me.
All right, Casey, thanks for your call. So, John, you interviewed Ron Paul.
I've talked to Ron Paul several times over the last several years, and to Rand Paul in recent weeks because of his success in Kentucky. Look, there are probably a lot of listeners out there rolling their eyes at the call, and I would tell them this, that the support for libertarian ideas, for less power in Washington, more power to the states, for smaller government, is growing. Is it a huge slice in the country? Obviously not. Where are the libertarians elected statewide? Is it a growing slice of the country that there are people who want to rethink these issues? I think that is the caller is absolutely correct on that point. In part, a reaction to what some see as reaching too far by the Obama administration on health care and other issues. And in part, the further west you go in the country, the more libertarian it is. That's why the settlers went there in the first place, to get away from the power of the central government. So it is a growing thematic. Is it growing to the point where it can start winning statewide? I don't see that yet, but it is growing.
We saw Warren Buffett, who's been a kind of hero to a lot of Americans for his enormous success as a businessman and for kind of his plain talk. He was subpoenaed to testify before a congressionally chartered panel this week investigating the financial crisis, and he talked about his stake in Moody's Corporation. What did he say, John Dickerson?
Well, this is the Financial Inquiry Crisis Commission, which is looking back at this enormous economic nightmare that the country has been involved in. And one of the things they're looking at is whether these ratings agencies basically ignored the growing problems with these mortgage-backed securities, said they were as good as cash when, in fact, they were not. And Warren Buffett is the largest Moody's shareholder, and he kind of backed off and didn't perform very well and kind of he defended Moody's, essentially.
We've talked about justice issues this hour. I want to talk about a justice issue involving baseball. We saw the Detroit Tigers pitcher Armando Galarraga robbed of the perfect game he pitched. And my question to the News Roundup panel is, should the baseball commissioner, Bud Selig, reverse that call, give him the perfect game that he clearly pitched. John Dickerson?
At first I thought that he should, but then in seeing how Galarraga behaved afterwards, in a situation here in which somebody like Warren Buffett doesn't behave at his moment, you see Galarraga acting like a perfect gentleman. And in some sense, that is the most wonderful lesson to those of us who have children of this whole thing. So maybe we should just let it stand.
Boy, the baseball umpire involved, Jim Joyce, acknowledged his mistake, apologized, was in tears when he came out for the next game, Karen.
I must say my impulse, too, was the same as John's. I wanted to meet Galarraga's mother. She raised a good kid.
Well, I think Bud Selig ought to reverse it. It's so rare. What, have there been 21 perfect games in baseball history? What do you think, John King?
This would have been the third in about 25 days, which would have been a huge shock. There's a long tradition that you don't overrule outs, safe and out, calls on the bases. And so Bud Selig is sticking within that tradition. I think just a remarkable show of class and dignity, a great lesson to children, a great lesson to parents who yell at the referees during their children's games, a great lesson to politicians. Maybe they should give him the Nobel Peace Prize.
John King, he's anchor of CNN's John King USA. And Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS. Thank you all for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks a lot.
Susan. Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.